Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's show, we look back at the events of 9/11, 20 years later. The U.S. Empire and 9/11 in historical context. We are joined by three guests that recently co-authored an article that will be published at Covert Action Magazine. We're joined by Professor Peter Dale Scott, Deep State Scholar. We are also joined by Aaron Good, Editor-at-Large at Covert Action Magazine, and independent researcher Ben Howard. Today on the Project Censored Show, 9/11, 20 years on. Stay tuned.
Crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are looking at the events of September 11th, 2001, 20 years on. We have three fantastic guests today that have co-authored a new piece that will be up at covertactionmagazine.com. On U.S. Empire and 9/11 in historical context, it also looks at the CIA and the failure to stop the 9/11 plotters. It's important that we go back and look at the 9/11 attacks and the rule of law, and quoting from the article, domestically, the attacks led to substantial changes in the federal government, the most obvious being the creation of a new cabinet-level department with the grave charge of securing the homeland, as it was called. Perhaps of greater consequence were the ways in which 9/11 further accelerated the abrogation of civil rights and the rule of law in the U.S. Going back through the Cold War and previously justified by a, quote, global communist conspiracy, end quote, the security organizations of the federal government had a long and prolific history of operations and episodes that appear straightforwardly illegal. On U.S. soil, these include McCarthyism, COINTELPRO, propaganda campaigns, and the surveillance and infiltration of groups engaging in constitutionally protected political activity. Well, of course, it also involves the international community. Internationally, since World War II, the U.S. has repeatedly violated the U.N. Charter, which outlaws even the threat of aggression against other nations. So let's get on and introduce our guest today and look at 9/11 in historical context. Not only are we 20 years on from 9/11, but the U.S.'s longest war just ended, technically, in Afghanistan, though I'm sure our guest today will have more to say about some of those affairs. I think today's discussion also will help give a clearer picture to our listeners about how Afghanistan plays in to this long so-called war on terror, which is a war of terror. Right now, I would like to introduce our guest today. We are delighted to welcome back to the program Aaron Good. He is Covert Action Magazine's editor at large. He is also going to be hosting the Covert Action Bulletin podcast beginning in just a couple of weeks. You may even hear yours truly doing some co-hosting with him around some of those issues. He is also the author of the forthcoming book, American Exception, Empire and the Deep State. Aaron Good, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Mickey. Great to be here.
And of course, our next guest, no stranger to the Project Censored audience, it is an honor and a delight to welcome back the one and only Professor Peter Dale Scott, author of dozens of books of poetry and prose, including Coming to Jakarta, Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, The Road to 9/11, and so much more. PeterDaleScott.net is where you can get more information about Peter's work. Peter Dale Scott, welcome back to the Project Censored show.
Good to be back with you, Mickey.
And third, we have Ben Howard. He is an independent researcher out of Boston, and the three of our guests today are co-authors of this article that will be up at Covert Action Magazine. Aaron Good, let's start with you. 20 years on, you have a great introduction in the article that really puts this in historical context. So why don't you kick things off for us and contextualize this, and then we'll bring all the voices in.
We had the idea of doing this article on the 20th anniversary, not exactly first because of the 20th anniversary. It came about when Peter had a large manuscript of essays, including some that weren't published. And at the end of this big manuscript, he had a lot of stuff related to 9/11. And the first part of this was dealing with the Massoud assassination. And you had me on the show in the early part of 2021 to talk about this article. And it was an article that people, I think, are more interested in, and I hope gets more exposure going forward, this December 2020 article that dealt with the assassination of the Northern Alliance chief Massoud with apparent CIA complicity in which no one had really hashed out before. And this was part of the manuscript that Peter had given me. And in the other part were things related to 9/11 and Richard Blee and Kofor Black and Tenet and some of these strange examples of bureaucratic incompetence that went beyond bureaucratic incompetence in terms of the mistakes that led to these plotters not being discovered by law enforcement. It wasn't just negligence or absentmindedness. There were steps taken by these officials, which were active measures, which kept them from being exposed. This was the bare bones of this manuscript, and Peter was working on other things. Not too many people in their early 90s are thinking about publishing, you know, multiple books, but in this time he's done a book on this Polish poet Milosz and another book on the Bronze Age, I believe. I haven't seen this manuscript, but I know that Peter's very
it's
busy.
So huge, you can't describe it. It's a book about everything.
If you say that, I believe you. I totally believe you. So in doing this, we agreed to do a second one, and I thought that Ben had done some great work on the TruAnon podcast on 9/11. He did this 6-part series without having written any books or articles. And so I thought if we brought all of us together, we could come up with a good 9/11 article. And that's what we did. How do you even approach 9/11? Because the event itself is so spectacular and had such awful consequences. And then if you want to get into the history that led up to it, well, you know, there's a lot of human history before 9/11. So we started looking at the important contextual events. So we tried to lay it out with the domestic consequences of 9/11, which, you know, as you mentioned, the abrogation of civil rights, the Patriot Act, it ramps up over Obama, warrantless wiretapping, the NDAA, 2012, that allows for these drastic actions to be taken, including the limitless detention for American citizens. And there's even, I make reference to Eric Holder responding to Rand Paul, a letter where Holder says, you know, we don't have any plans to do this, but yeah, we could take action, executive action against American citizens on American soil, which is essentially the attorney general saying that the attorney general believes that the president has a statutory right to act as jury and executioner of Americans on American soil.
Or abroad. And we've seen them enact that abroad, the killing of American citizens like Al-Awlaki.
The brutality of the U.S., you know, national security state abroad, it's not that unusual, although they did go further with things like extraordinary rendition and so-called enhanced interrogation and so on. But, you know, it's shocking that this would have been asserted by somebody. And it wasn't asserted by Dick Cheney. It was asserted by, you know, at the height of paranoia over the war on terror, it was asserted by the Obama administration. This is a bipartisan affair, and a lot of it has its roots in 9/11. And when you look at what Obama was doing with the NDAA and this particular right of being able to like execute people, this was at the same time that Obama is overseeing these operations in Libya and Syria that are using Al-Qaeda assets as U.S. proxies. It's quite serious and alarming when you think of it that way, and yet it doesn't get the kind of coverage because we'd rather talk about Russiagate. So internationally, the U.S. goes even further in terms of abandoning the rule of law. There are treaties about how we're not allowed to torture people and so on, but we get around that with enhanced interrogation and also by extraordinary rendition, taking people to Turkey or Egypt or Uzbekistan, where they do torture people. It had enormous consequences, but the consequences were not where the U.S. was law-abiding, peaceful, global leadership, freedom and democracy and all that beforehand. There's a long history that we get into to set the stage for this in as economical a language as we can, but still trying to cover the main points here.
Aaron Good, you just gave us a lot to think about contextually setting it up. You mentioned Ahmed Shah Massoud, the leader of the Northern Alliance, who happened to be against U.S. ground troops coming into Afghanistan. And of course, there's a history to that. And the U.S. trying to get in and wanted to build a pipeline. And the Clinton administration, of course, this is also centering around some of the lobbying and actions of a group that later wrote a document, Rebuilding America's Defenses, right? The Project for the New American Century, the neoconservatives laying the plans that actually ended up in the Bush administration becoming the Bush Doctrine. Peter Dale Scott, I wanted to bring you in. Let's not forget some of your books, The American Deep State, Big Money, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy, American War Machine, deep politics and the CIA's global drug connection and the road to Afghanistan, as well as the road to 9/11, wealth, empire, and the future of America. How does Afghanistan fit into the puzzle of 9/11? This was planned prior to the 9/11 attacks.
Well, first of all, I want to add one more book because its title sums up the framework that we're dealing with, and that's my book, Drugs, Oil, and War. I wrote it in response to the second U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, for which I'm convinced the plotters of 9/11, that's what they had in mind, to put U.S. troops into Asia. And the best place to put them is where you can work with local forces who can pay for themselves because they're involved in the drug traffic. There was a man called Hekmatyar that the CIA used back in the first U.S. involvement in Afghanistan back in 1980, and he had very little popular backing in Afghanistan, but the Pakistanis preferred him for that reason, and we were working with Pakistan, and that he was the best funded because he was briefly for a few years during that first U.S. involvement, the world's largest drug trafficker, thanks to all the money and arms, et cetera, that were coming from the United States and Saudi Arabia back in 1980. I also want to say a word about Massoud, because the immediate link, why is he relevant to 9/11? It's not just that he opposed U.S. troops. He was a grateful recipient of U.S. arms, and the Pakistanis were not very happy with that because he was also being supported by the Soviet Union and by India. He was a really authentically popular leader, but not very good for the Pakistanis. But anyway, he was murdered when? September the 9th. And the next day, on September the 10th, the deputies of the principal planners on the U.S. response met to sort of hammer a few details into shape. And the next day after that, we had the 9/11 event, which more or less made the excuse, the pretext for the U.S. invasion that was being planned the day before the hit on the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, which would provide the pretext for what they were already planning. So that's why I think it really is important to focus on Massoud's murder and see that it is a part of this complex of events. And then it's very interesting to find that it was being plotted some months before in the summer by two people, one in England, Al-Siri, and one in America, a humble postal worker by the name of Sattar. And Sattar deserves a place in history for one reason and one reason only, and that is that he was the communications link for Al-Siri, who was a leader of the Egyptian Mujahideen in England, working together with the blind sheikh Abdelrahman, who was not only in America, he was in the Springfield, Missouri prison in America, totally under American control. And anything that Sattar said to Al-Siri, I think we can assume two things. One is it was something that was taken seriously, could even lead to a fatwa because it was coming from the blind sheikh. Sattar didn't have that kind of authority. He wasn't an emir, he was a postal worker. He was the communications link between Abdelrahman and the outside world, even though Abdelrahman was in U.S. prison. And the other second thing we know was, because of his importance in that role, every word he spoke to Al-Siri was listened to by the FBI. And the U.S. government, this came out about 10 years later, and the U.S. government, so yes, we knew that somebody's assassination had been ordered. We didn't know whose it was. But in the context of Afghanistan, there was only one person it could have been, because the only opposition left to the Taliban was Massoud. And the government knew that and was sending all their aid to Mysore, but it had come to a head recently that now for the first time the U.S. wanted to send troops, and for the first time Mysore was making it very clear that he didn't want U.S. troops, and what happens next? He gets murdered from an order that comes really in its origins from the United States, although from an avowed enemy of the United States, Abdulrahman. But Abdulrahman originally came to the U.S. on a CIA visa and was involved in projects together with the CIA. And I think we should mention one which is very relevant, was the training of Arabs in America who were wanted to be jihadis. They wanted to fight for Islam. And America, of course, was fine to have them fight for Islam as they didn't fight in America. So they had yet another Arab, an Egyptian called Muhammad Ali, who was working with the special forces at Fort Bragg. He had an official status in America. And he was training these people, and he was training them in 1991. And when you see references to this in the U.S. press, they say for Afghanistan, that doesn't work historically, because by 1990, the jihadi war in Afghanistan was over. But it's very clear that they were being trained to fight in Bosnia. And that sets up a model here, which we have to think about really in terms of the present day, because the U.S. is facilitating the training of jihadis to go fight in Bosnia, which then provides the pretext for U.S. armed forces to go in and fight the people that we've already sent in. And you might say, well, Aaron pointed out in the last show, this is at a time when they want to build a pipeline across the Balkan Peninsula from the Black Sea to the Adriatic, that comes right through southern Bosnia and particularly Kosovo. We'll come to that in a moment. And eventually the pipeline is built. The United States have a big armed base now, Fort Bonsteel, very close to the western end of the pipeline. And this is a pattern that repeated itself in Kosovo 4 years later. Once again, U.S. supplied support. I don't want to say troops here, but there was a lot of U.S. support to fight Al-Qaeda veterans who, according to a Dutchman there, were getting covert aid from the CIA by planes that flew in at night. I'm taking a lot of time on this one detail because we've just seen the war in Afghanistan officially ends. And virtually the final act on ending the war in Afghanistan is to proclaim the war against ISIS-Khorasan or ISIS-K. And it looks like it would be a low-key war, of course, but they say over the horizon, which means drones. But they have the pretext to go on, in effect, go on fighting. And what particularly alarms me about this one, because when they say ISIS-K, and the K stands for Khorasan, 90% of Khorasan was not in Afghanistan, it was in Iran. So it's not only a pretext for the continuation of what's been going on a lower level, it is also a possible pretext for the expansion of war into Iran itself, which we haven't really had in a serious way yet.
That's the voice of Professor Peter Dale Scott, and we are talking about 9/11 U.S. Empire in historical context. And Peter Dale Scott, thank you for that crash course of history. And you mentioned the NSPD. For people that don't know what that is, that's National Security Presidential Directive -9. This is all in this article that'll be posted at Covert Action Magazine. We're also joined by Aaron Good and Ben Howard. After this brief musical break, we'll continue our conversation around the 20th anniversary of the events of September 11th. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In today's program, we're looking back at 9/11 on the 20th anniversary, the commemoration of the U.S. Empire and 9/11 of historical context. We're joined by Aaron Good. He's editor-at-large at Covert Action Magazine. He's also author of a forthcoming book, American Exception, Empire in the Deep State. Ben Howard is going to join in this segment of the program as well, an independent researcher that is also co-author with Aaron Good. And our other guest today, Peter Dale Scott. They have a new article looking at the history of this issue, the history of 9/11 and U.S. Empire, that'll be up at Covert Action Magazine. Before the break, Peter Dale Scott, you just gave us a lot of very significant information that's relative to the present and what's happening in Afghanistan. Ben Howard, I wanted to bring you in here. Regarding this presidential directive and involving a lot of noise that was happening the summer of 2001, some of what we know, and at Project Censored, this was one of the stories we published just a few years ago, involving Kofor Black, the former director of CIA's Counterterrorism Center, George Tenet, who was the former director of the CIA. Chris Whipple wrote about this in Politico. It involved Richard Blee. These are some interesting key players. And the reason I bring this up is because one of the things that they were talking about in that summer, and I'm not talking about Condoleezza Rice in the presidential briefing of August 6th, where she later then says nobody had any idea. And the report was titled Bin Laden Determined to Strike in the U.S. Well, in this conversation, Blee said, quote, "There will be significant terrorist attacks against the United States in the coming weeks or months. The attacks will be spectacular. They may be multiple." Ben Howard, jump in here and talk a little bit about some of that context.
There's so much to say about Richard Blee in particular, who is a figure that we don't actually know very much about. And a lot of researchers, Kevin Fenton, John Duffy, Ray Novosielski, they were some people who really looked into his past and what he was up to. I think he's a very important link because we have these geopolitical objectives in Afghanistan that we've spoken about. We have this great quote from Dick Cheney when he was CEO of Halliburton in 1998. That was his job just before he became vice president, was CEO of a major oil services company. He says in 1998 that he can't think of a region which is shot up to become more important for oil purposes than the Caspian, which obviously is where Afghanistan is. And this goes back even further than that. I mean, you have Zbigniew Brzezinski obviously talking about the importance of this region, the Grand Chessboard, and obviously his involvement in the region going back to 1979.
Ben Howard, sorry to interrupt you, but I want you to continue. But one quick footnote on Cheney that some people may forget is that not only was he at Halliburton, but he was originally tasked with finding a vice presidential candidate for George W. Bush, and then he basically found himself. Anyway, back to you, Ben.
Certainly, there's a lot to say about that election and its importance in these events. As you mentioned, Kofor Black also had a very important role. Kofor Black was head of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. He was brought in by Tenet in the late 90s, I think 98 was when he was brought in. That was around the time that Blee was brought in as well to run the CIA's Alec station, the Bin Laden issues station. So Blee's responsibility was specifically all things related to Osama Bin Laden. And this was part of the pretext. There were some Al-Qaeda groups operating in Uzbekistan. And so this was part of the pretext for why they traveled to Uzbekistan, Blee and Kofor Black. And this was beginning in 1999, I believe, they began setting up deals with the Uzbek government, the Karimov government, setting up the K2 airbase, which became a major airbase as a part of the U.S. invasion, setting up agreements between both CIA special operators as well as U.S. military special operators and the Uzbek government. And then also, Blee was the point person for a lot of the negotiations with Massoud, particularly in 2000 after the USS Cole bombing. He was really pushing Clinton for an expanded relationship with Shah Massoud. So we don't know what Blee's role may have been in the assassination of Massoud. I would love to get more documents and investigate that more in detail, because I'm certain based on what else he did that he probably would have had a role if there was in fact American complicity. But what we certainly do know is that during that time period, you gave that great quote about the attacks will be spectacular. And it was at precisely that time in the summer of 2001 when he was receiving messages from his subordinates at the Alec station, one Tom Wilshire in particular, informing him of the fact that Wilshire and others in the Alec station had known for months, in fact, going all the way back to January 2000, that two of the alleged hijackers had been in the United States. The Alec station knew this information. Going back to January 2000, Tom Wilshire personally prevented people within the Alec station from getting this information to the FBI. And Wilshire is, in the summer of 2001, at precisely the moment when Blee is warning of a spectacular attack, Wilshire is informing him via cables of the importance of Khalid al-Madar and how necessary it is to get him and relay this information to the FBI. Now, I think that Wilshire was probably doing a little bit of CYA there personally. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, Blee had the opportunity and should have taken action on this. He was during this period running the Sunni Extremism Center. He had been promoted. They knew that these people from Al-Qaeda had been in the United States. These were two people who were allegedly central to the plot. They were allegedly two of the hijackers, according to the U.S. government's official story of what happened. The CIA knew that they were in the United States. This information was not given to the FBI, as Aaron alluded to. Active measures taken by people, Tom Wilshire and others within the Alex station, to prevent it from reaching the FBI. Blee knew about this at a time when he was warning of spectacular attacks, in a context where he had been laying the groundwork for the American invasion of Afghanistan. And then 9/11 happens and he becomes the Kabul station chief. Tenet promotes him again to be the chief of station in Kabul so that he's in a position to carry out whatever it was that they were planning, which we don't know the full details of, and we don't know what Blee did after the war began.
And Ben Howard, including Pakistani ISI involvement in the wiring of money to another one of the key members fingered by the 9/11 Commission report, the official story, Muhammad Atta.
We didn't develop so much the ISI involvement, although that certainly is there. But what we most focused on was GID involvement via a man named Al-Bayoumi, who was almost certainly a GID handler.
GID Saudi, for our listeners.
Saudi intelligence.
Yeah, good. Yeah,
yes.
Just want to be sure that our listeners know, because you all are very familiar with a lot of the names and the acronyms. And when people are listening on radio, they don't get to see what. But they can see them in the article that'll be up at covertactionmagazine.com. I just wanted to take a very quick moment to remind everyone you're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We are talking about 9/11 U.S. Empire in historical context today. Our three guests are Aaron Good, Ben Howard, and Peter Dale Scott. After this brief musical break, we'll continue our conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's show, we're looking back at 9/11, 20 years later, the U.S. Empire and 9/11 in historical context. We're also hearing more about the CIA, the FBI, NSA protection for Al-Qaeda members. We'll get into more of that. Also, the failures of the CIA to stop the 9/11 plotters. You heard before the break, Aaron Good, Ben Howard, Peter Dale Scott, co-authors of this article up at covertactionmagazine.com. All the details there are in it, and it is meticulously noted. It is meticulously cited and footnoted, which is commonplace. Anybody here familiar with the work of Aaron Good, Peter Dale Scott, Ben Howard knows that when you make extraordinary claims, you need extraordinary evidence, and there are extraordinary footnotes here because the details matter. And so, Aaron Good, I want to roll back around to you about the details and how they matter. And going back and just connecting some more of these dots, I mentioned in passing earlier the Project for the New American Century. Of course, people like Dick Cheney and others were key members of this. They wrote this document called Rebuilding America's Defenses that had some really fascinating information in it that turned out to be quite prescient. In many ways, it kind of looks like a blueprint for what the George W. Bush administration would eventually do. And of course, some of this is based on the work of Brzezinski and the Grand Chessboard during the 1990s, during the Bill Clinton presidency, when PNAC was founded. That's, again, the Project for New American Century. They wrote a lot of very damning kind of information about what they thought they wanted to or needed to do. Aaron Good, could you walk us through that?
In the lead up to 9/11, and really in the time period following the dissolution of the Soviet Union, there was something of a vacuum, especially in Central Asia. And in the U.S., the sort of progressive, law-abiding, non-imperialist elements of the political establishment in the post-World War II era, they become weaker and weaker. There's very little in the way of more aggressive kind of world domination type thinking. And what there is maybe represented by somebody like Strobe Talbot, who's still like on the Council of Foreign Relations. And he was saying, we don't need a great game in Asia. We should have some sort of cooperation, you know, almost something like what the Chinese are saying. He doesn't use the term win-win, but that's the way China offers something different. They say, let's have win-win economic relationships and we'll build railroads and so on. So there's nobody really in the U.S. that's advocating for that. That's got a lot of power. You have the Brzezinski perspective. And I think Obama is considered by some to have been influenced by Brzezinski while at Columbia and so on. And it seems to be reflected in the policies he carried out. Well, Brzezinski at the end of the 90s is writing all about the Eurasian Balkans. And this goes back to him for the 70s, using this area to destabilize the Soviet Union by arming the jihadis and using Islam as a dagger to strike the Soviet Union. And he's writing that now with the Soviet Union gone, the key for the U.S. to hold on to its position as the global hegemon is really to maintain its dominance over Eurasia as long as possible. And you have the neoconservatives who make Brzezinski seem like, you know, a mild-mannered bureaucrat. And they're writing about how in the Middle East, the control of energy is very important. Iraq is this very important region. A lot of them are very pro-Israel neoconservatives who are also fixated upon making sure that there's no real countervailing force to the Israeli/U.S. dominance. And so it's just determined in the establishment that it's going to be important to assert domination over the energy heartlands of the Middle East and Central Asia. But both in the writings of Brzezinski and in the writings of the neocons, even more explicitly, it's just hard to get people mobilized to fight a war. We're all comfortable watching TV. We've got this internet, all these things. It's going to be hard to mobilize people, just like it's historically always been, without something like a Pearl Harbor. Okay, Brzezinski says this in a way, and PNAC infamously says this in Rebuilding America's Defenses.
Let's read the quote exactly from the Rebuilding America's Defenses, because it says, "The process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor." And just after the events of 9/11/2001, the Bush administration began calling the event the new Pearl Harbor and the Pearl Harbor of the 21st century. So it's pre-propaganda.
Yes, and if I can just add to that, the idea that you need major changes and you're not going to get them without a catastrophic event doesn't begin with PNAC and with Brzezinski. It was already being said a decade earlier when the people were coming up with contingency planning for emergency powers. It was always part of the emergency planning that it's planning that won't be effective unless we have a catastrophic event. And I think the first time, at the beginning, it may have been more defensive. You know, we have to be ready for a catastrophic event. But by the end, you really hear the tone that we need a catastrophic event because we need the emergency powers. And if I could say a bit more about that, going back to the theme of drugs, oil, and war, that it was a consensus among oil experts in the 90s that the world's biggest oil reserves that were not yet developed were all in Central Asia. And that's why geopolitics, the theme of which was to control the world, you have to control Central Asia. It got a new kick when it was backed by the idea of dominating oil. Now, there's one other aspect of this that we haven't said enough about, and that is not just propagandizing from Brzezinski and from PNAC for an escalation, but you had planning. Not exactly inside the government. You had planning authorized by Reagan in 1982. There had been planning ever since Korea. What do we do if America is decapitated by a nuclear bomb and we lose all three branches of government? We have to be ready to take over from that. You have to plan for a non-constitutional government. This planning begins under Eisenhower. And Eisenhower did something which had big consequences later. He had good reasons to be a bit suspicious of his own military, who were full of racists who responded very badly to Brown versus the Board of Education. You had cliques inside the active armed forces that were setting up links with post-fascist remnants in Europe. So he did a bold thing. He gave a lot of the leadership in this planning to private elements, specifically to Frank Stanton of CBS and the head of a major insurance company we used to go fishing with, people that he thought he could trust. Eisenhower had sent letters to 10 heads of corporations, giving them the power to take over if there was a nuclear attack. Well, all through the 80s and 90s, they were expanding on these powers. The whole story is interesting, but we don't have time for the whole story. Flash forward to 1982, and there is a committee set up to strengthen these powers, and above all, strengthen what already exists, a parallel communications network outside the official government communications network for an alternative network. And the man in charge of all this kind of planning is the vice president, George H.W. Bush. And the action officer for all this planning is a man called Oliver North. But Oliver North wore two hats. And he, in his second hat, as the action officer for the, I think they called it Operation 908. The overall thing was also called Project Pegasus. But the network they were building up, there was a hint in it. They called it the Doomsday Network. In his other hat, Ollie North was trying to get U.S. arms to Iran as part of these Iran-Contra deals, which were not legal. The network was under the control of FEMA, which had been set up by Brzezinski in 1998, I believe, or 99, together with Samuel Huntington, who was famous for having already written a book in which he said there was an excess of democracy in America, and America faced the risk of becoming ungovernable. You do have to remember there was a very powerful anti-war movement then. There were very powerful Black militants developing in the ghettos, particularly after the murder of Martin Luther King. So it wasn't just a wild fantasy. There were many people who thought the way Huntington did, a man called Lewis Powell, who ended up on the Supreme Court in the 1970s. He wrote the so-called Powell Memorandum in 1971. By the way, he wrote it at the behest of the Chamber of Commerce. So he was writing it on behalf of U.S. industry, saying we have to do something about getting control. We have to put a lot of more money into it. And there were foundations, four foundations in particular, that started funding a big anti-democratic campaign publicly. One of those foundations, the Bradley Foundation, has been funding militants and Trumpists, and they're part of the history of our country at this moment. But I just want to come back to the planning, the doomsday planning for the 80s and 90s. It involved two of the people who were planning for continuity of government and the implementation of continuity of government planning. Two of these people were Donald Rumsfeld, who the whole two decades was the head of a big pharma corporation. And the other big man in the planning was Dick Cheney, who at the beginning of the 80s was a humble congressman from Wyoming, which shouldn't be the lead state in planning U.S. foreign policy. But he then, in the second half of the 90s, became the CEO of Halliburton, which has already been mentioned, the largest oil services company responsible for building the facilities for Chevron and Exxon in Kazakhstan, which needed some kind of U.S. presence, which was supplied by the two forever wars, the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan, both of which were discussed in the immediate hours after 9/11. And it was agreed, we'll do Afghanistan first. And that was summed up by NSPD 9. One of the consequences of the permanent consequences of 9/11 was COG was implemented on the morning of 9/11. And I think it had already, in my book, The Road to 9/11, I argue that it was already being used even before it had been implemented. It is a key part of the 9/11 story. And then there were two states of emergency that were declared. which need by law to be renewed every year and have been renewed every single year, first by Republicans, no surprise, then by Obama. Although a former Democratic congressman and I tried to mount a campaign to make sure it wouldn't be renewed by Obama in 2009, that it was. And I'm going to make a prediction on this show that before this month of September is over, it will have been renewed yet again by Democratic President Joe Biden. And if he doesn't renew it, then that is a very major change, because all kinds of COG powers are being preserved by these things. One more that hasn't been mentioned is the militarization of security in America by the creation of NORTHCOM, a U.S. military command, which has responsibility for North America, the way which SOUTHCOM has military responsibility for South America. That is a huge change in the role of the so-called Department of Defense in this country. And it brings us back to the need that we have to really break the power of the military-industrial complex, which voted more money for the defense under Trump than Trump wanted, and has just voted more money for defense under Biden, more money than Biden wanted. So we have a very, very severe problem. But one way we can undo this whole package is to begin to undo the cloud of unknowing that surrounds 9/11 and get rid of that state of emergency so that we don't have all of these secret powers.
Thank you, Peter Dale. Scott, we'll return to our conversation. Aaron Good, Ben Hard, we're going to bring you back in. Just a reminder, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We'll continue our conversation on 9/11, U.S. Empire, and historical context after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In the final segment of today's program, we're going to conclude our conversation, one that clearly could go on for several shows, with all of our guests today. Aaron Good is Covert Action Magazine Editor-at-Large, author of the forthcoming book, American Exception, Empire and the Deep State. He's also going to be hosting the Covert Action Bulletin podcast beginning in just a couple of weeks. Our other guest is Ben Howard, an independent researcher out of Boston, will also be involved in that podcast. I may also be popping in and out as a guest host with Aaron Good there. And of course, Professor Peter Dale Scott, the author of dozens of books of poetry and prose. The books that we're talking about today, so many relevant ones from Peter Dale Scott, from The American Deep State, American War Machine, The War Conspiracy, The Road to 9/11, so many relevant books about this going back quite a long ways. Aaron Good, let's go to you here. We wanted to bring things back around to the CIA. And of course, George Herbert Walker Bush, his name came up earlier from the Reagan years. Let's also not forget he was head of the CIA in the 1970s. And also Rumsfeld goes back to the Department of Defense going back toward the 70s. Aaron Good, you wanted to jump in here.
As Peter laid out, there are several black boxes that are brought to bear on this whole story and what we can piece together of it. COG, continuity of government, or the Doomsday Project, which allows for overriding authority of some kind, we don't always know, and also communications networks that are secret, the details of which we don't know. This is one black box of 9/11. And of course, the CIA, we understand as a black box in and of itself. I think that one thing that this article does, which in this format we can't do justice to because of time, but hopefully on my other podcast we'll have more time to go into, is that Ben lays out the CIA story as it relates to 9/11, I think better than has ever been done before. And it's really an accomplishment. What I wanted to mention was the CIA has its covert operations apparatus that existed from its creation in 1947 up until the 70s without many snags. And it, the snags it did run into, like, say, the presidency of John Kennedy, it seemed to be able to overcome. And Nixon, you could put into that category in a strange way also. But as a result of Watergate, you had many revelations about the intelligence community. And so they changed some of the ways that they operated. And things weren't done necessarily by the CIA in a comprehensible bureaucratic fashion, protected by state secrecy still, right? Instead, they actually farmed some of these things out to other entities over in the Middle East, especially related to the Saudis and to all of these petrodollars that had accumulated because of the oil shocks and so on, and the new importance of oil and oil money and oil dollars because of the breakdown of the Bretton Woods financial system resulting from Vietnam War overspending, that you had this unaccountable source of financial largesse that was commanded by allied states of the U.S., really of the U.S. deep state, of the oil majors and other powerful elements of the U.S. power structure. And so they outsourced these things in the 1970s, and explicitly former head of Saudi intelligence says, we created this club, the Safari Club, to do these things because the CIA couldn't, because they were held up by Congress and so on. A lot of these kind of things take place when George H.W. Bush is the head of the CIA. He's brought in because Colby seems insufficiently devious, I guess, for people like Kissinger and so on. And so they bring in Bush. I'm oversimplifying it, but really Bush is brought in because he's considered more acceptable to the establishment than Colby was at that point. These things take place under Carter. Carter makes some moves towards reforming it with Stansfield Turner. He fires these guys like Shackley and Kleins, who are sort of notorious covert operators, but they are able to sort of go in freelance. But then when Reagan takes over, they're brought in. So the shortly after Reagan takes office, there's a huge arms sale to the Saudis, and a lot of money is made from this. And a lot of this money is used to fund more covert operations. And Iran-Contra dealt with a lot of these shady dealings, but never really satisfactorily. In the end, George H.W. Bush can't be prosecuted because he pardons the people who could have incriminated him, you know, like Poindexter and Weinberger, if I recall correctly. So the scandals of the 70s create new, even less accountable intelligence arrangements. But then under Reagan, they're brought in more to the legitimate version of the American national security state. There's some pushback on Iran-Contra, but it doesn't really take. And so we're left with the worst aspects of what the 1970s intelligence investigations were trying to examine. And that's the context of what Ben writes about with this GID. We can't really figure out what the CIA was doing. And on top of that, the GID, which acted as a sock puppet or a proxy for the U.S. in the 80s and so on, and Ben uncovered more about that and had a lot to say in this article.
Well, Ben Howard, let's go to you.
I think there are two myths that I hoped to dispel. The first is there seems to be a growing second cover story for 9/11, that it was a Saudi operation, that the Americans were somehow tricked. This seems to be developing, particularly as more information about the Saudi involvement in 9/11 comes out. But as we develop in this piece, there is direct CIA complicity with what was happening before 9/11. The CIA was aware of these people. And in particular, when you talk about Khalid al-Madar and Nawaf al-Hazmi, two alleged hijackers who came to the U.S., the CIA was aware of their presence in the U.S. and didn't report that elsewhere. You start to look at the involvement of Khalid al-Madar in the USS Cole bombing, and this is where Anwar al-Awlaki and George Tenet comes in, because there was recent information which came out, which was reported by Alex Rubenstein, among others, who's an independent reporter, that George Tenet had secured Anwar al-Awlaki's release from Yemeni prison following the USS Cole bombing. And of course, that includes the allegation that Anwar al-Awlaki was involved in the USS Cole bombing. This is a very serious allegation. It would seem to imply that al-Awlaki was acting as not only a Saudi agent, but also a CIA asset, or was at least protected by the CIA to some extent. This is very relevant because al-Awlaki, as the 9/11 Commission reports, provided housing for Khalid al-Madar and Nawaf al-Hazmi, two alleged hijackers, when they were all living in Alexandria, Virginia. He was also in contact with Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Madar. This is also in the 9/11 Commission report before the USS Cole bombing, when those two men, al-Hazmi and al-Madar, arrived in San Diego. And so the idea that al-Awlaki was probably a part of whatever joint Saudi CIA operation was involved in protecting these two alleged hijackers in the U.S. There are quite a lot of details to support this that I can't mention now, but they're developed in the piece, certainly. And so the idea that Tenet would have protected al-Awlaki is quite startling, particularly given that al-Awlaki remained at large. In fact, the FBI took a lot of steps to protect him from the 9/11 Commission. The 9/11 Commission wanted to get in touch with him, find out what he knew about the hijackers. They knew some of the details about his connections with the alleged hijackers. They could not get all of the details. And in part, this was because the FBI was helping to protect him. So this is very alarming. And then obviously, of course, the fact that al-Awlaki was killed in a drone strike, and he was an American citizen who was killed in Yemen in a drone strike, as well as his two children were killed subsequently. So it's very alarming to consider that this man was a material witness. He had very important information in his head about possible Saudi involvement with this, about possible CIA complicity with this. And he was extrajudicially murdered by the American state. As to why that happened, I don't know. But when you consider the context of these facts, it is certainly quite concerning.
To say the least, Ben Howard, and before that, Aaron Good, editor-at-large, Covert Action Magazine. Peter Dale Scott, we have a few minutes left, and I know that's always a challenge, but I wanted to take the show out with you. When I listen to you, when I read your work, there's a degree of sobriety about the way you approach this topic that few seem to be able to muster. That's something that I deeply appreciate about your work. In the few minutes we have left, can you maybe wrap a conclusion out here in what you really hope to get out of this article at Covert Action Magazine 20 years after 9/11?
I'd like to begin by picking up from where Ben was talking about the protection of people we then regard as terrorists. I think the most obvious and least disputed case of this is the man Ali Mohammed, who I mentioned earlier, who was an Egyptian at the Fort Bragg Special Forces base in North Carolina, training jihadis in the New York area to go off and fight in Bosnia. He shouldn't have been free to do this at all, but he was never picked up in America. He made the mistake of going to Canada to meet a well-known terrorist who was arriving with double passports. I mean, once they picked up the arrival, the man that Ali Mohammed went to meet, it was obvious that he was a no-goodnik because he had passports under more than one name and he had other incriminating equipment. So they picked up Ali Mohammed, but not for very long. Ali Mohammed gave them a telephone number and said, phone this number and you will release me. So they phoned the number and it turned out to be the San Francisco office of the FBI. And they did release him. And did this have consequences? It sure did, because he went to Kenya and initiated the casing of the U.S. Embassy for the U.S. Embassy bombing, which, let's not forget, was the first overt act, terrorist act of al-Qaeda against an American installation, and the justification for so much of the upending of our constitutional liberty since. That happened, and it wouldn't have happened the way it happened if the FBI had not ordered the release of Ali Mohammed from the RCMP in Vancouver. Now, all of that is detail, but if I'm still capable of thinking in a large way about all of this, I talk about deep events, structural deep events, which change our American society and change it for the worse. The key example of this was 9/11. This whole state of surveillance and control and militarization, it has been not just defending itself, but augmenting itself over the years. And it's really very vital that we try to turn this around. And I think some people go away from a show like this saying it's hopeless. I'll just try to forget about it. It's not hopeless. This is a very healthy society. There is no other society in the world where you could begin to mount the kind of investigation and opposition that you have in this country. And I think one of the first steps is that we have to understand what's being done to us. If you want to be a good citizen, check out what we're saying about 9/11. And if that makes sense to you, then check out what I've been saying to the Kennedy assassination, which I think is a very similar event. Something can and must be done about this. And if nothing is done about it, then, and only then, this won't be America as we think of America.
Peter Dale Scott, a good note to end on, and certainly a wise reminder that there are things we can do, particularly when we're armed with the power that knowledge gives. And you have been doing that for so many decades. Very grateful for you, Peter Dale, and all of your work. Aaron Good, very grateful that you are working in concert. And Ben Howard, first time on the show. It was a pleasure and honor to meet you. The U.S. Empire and 9/11 in historical context, 20 years on. I think our listeners today at the Project Censored Show got a lot of homework assignments to do, and a great place to start this history is going to covertactionmagazine.com to read this article, and we'll follow up, and I look forward to having you all back on the program. Peter Dale Scott, Aaron Good, Ben Howard, thanks for joining us on the Project Censored Show, and if you want to learn more about Peter Dale Scott's work, you can go to peterdalescott.net. We want to smash, crash, pass, mass, blast the system. And that does it for another Project Censored show today. I'd like to dedicate today's program to the late, great Ed Asner, who was a lifelong activist and supporter of labor, of social justice, as well as the pursuit of truth. I'd like to tell you you've been listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio, established in 2010 by myself, Mickey Helf, along with Peter Phillips. I'm executive producer and host of the program. Anthony Fest is our longtime senior producer. He's the man behind the curtain. Project Censored Show airs on roughly 50 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work or to find any of our previous archive programs, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram before we get deplatformed, and be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your digital tethering device's podcast application. Please feel free to share your feedback about our work at projectcensored.org. Thanks to all of you, our listeners, for continuing to tune in after 11 years. We'll see you next time. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks of all the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity citizens. And the times for the master thief. Combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love of the brothers in us.